I want to look at the ideal of marriage tonight. And the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about marriage in terms of how the Bible would define it. And I think we're on the right track when we say marriage is this leaving, cleaving, committed relationship, the one flesh part. I think we're also on the right track when we say that the end result of marriage for believers is our own sanctification, and you have that surfaced in Ephesians chapter 5 and then 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Paul will talk about how the husband sanctifies the wife and the wife sanctifies the husband, and there are a lot of purposes of marriage. There's, of course, the raising of children and the establishing of a home for those children. There's becoming a foundation for a community. I mean, the structure of a community or the families that make it up. And you could talk a lot about marriage in terms of providing comfort and as a cure for loneliness. That all of those things are very, very biblical. They're very valid. But the big ultimate purpose of marriage is sanctification. It's to help each other get to heaven. It's to help each other become more Christ-like. And again, nobody can help you be sanctified on this side of the of heaven more than a mate, and no one can be a greater obstacle to you being sanctified than a mate. Yeah, there's power in that relationship, and so it ought to be a relationship that's used for the glory of God. Now, tonight, I want to give you just, I've got seven, and I think we can get through seven, but I want to give you seven obstacles to a happy or solid marriage. And I shouldn't even say happy, because the goal of marriage is not necessarily happiness, but let's face it, you want to have a happy marriage, you want to have a joyful marriage, you want to have a productive marriage, and I want to give you seven obstacles to having a quality marriage. And some of these are just, we'll mention in passing. But I think the first big obstacle to having a quality marriage is that one or both of you just aren't committed to the relationship. I mean, that's sort of a deal breaker. You know, sometimes people will come for marriage counseling, and you know, the first question you ask, and the reason you ask it is because you're looking at their faces, and you say, "Are both of you here because you want to be here?" And quite frankly, people will say, "Well, no, I'm not." And I don't really know how the conversation is supposed to proceed after somebody says, "I don't even want to be here. I don't care." There has to be a level of commitment to that relationship. And I think that you know that. That's why, for instance, adultery is grounds for divorce. I mean, if a person just isn't committed to this relationship, there isn't much to work with here. If you're married and you say, you know, I want somebody to take care of my house, but I want to be able to have relationships with anybody I want to, I mean, there really isn't much to work with there. And some marriages obviously are very quickly on their way to the divorce court because people aren't committed to that relationship. It's not the singular relationship apart from Christ that their loyalties are to. There are, our culture, I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. Our culture is in some ways the easiest culture to live in because of our wealth. It's also maybe in another way the hardest culture to live in because of its complexity. And you know, we've joked about, you know, the culture is so difficult you got to go to school 13 years to learn how to function in it. It's a complicated culture in which to maneuver in. And I think our culture has added difficulties in maintaining the level of commitment that you need in your marriage. A lot of temptation in our culture. You know, Jordan Peterson was talking about, any of you listen to Peterson? I mention him and nobody starts. His videos get millions of hits. He's a psychiatrist who's a conservative guy and was in Canada, but anyway, now he's a worldwide figure. But one of the things Jordan Peterson says about marriage or about our culture, he says, one thing we don't know yet, he said, because you don't think about it, but it's a relatively new phenomena. We don't know the full effect of what it means for men and women to work together in the same space. He said, because if you think of the history of the world and then you think about even other cultures, men have always worked in the field. Women have tended to work in the home. Or men and women have worked in segregated places. He said, the ideal that men and women would both work in the same office doing the same job is new to humanity. It's less than 100 years old. And he said, when you think about that in regards to a marriage, first of all, if men and women work in the same office, there's added temptation. I mean, if you work with all guys, you're not going to be, I mean, you know, you don't see women from 8 to 5. It makes perfect sense that you're going to have less temptation to even think about not being entirely faithful to your mate because the opportunity just isn't there. But the other problem that men and women working together, and again, it's a modern phenomenon, really, is that it creates the possibility that in life you really are going to struggle, perhaps in a season of your life, with people of the opposite sex that you feel like you have a lot more in common with. And that's going to be a great temptation to emotional adultery. Because you think about it, we meet in college, say, man, woman, they meet in college. He's going to be, I don't know, what's he going to be? He's going to be an accountant. And she's going to be a nurse. But they love each other in college. They're in college for 4 years. They both graduate. They get married. They're in love. Well, now she's going to go work in a place with other men who are in the medical profession. He's going to go work in a place with a lot of women who are in the financial area. They got married. They fell in love. But she's a nurse. He's an accountant. Different personalities, different thoughts. But now they're going to go spend the next 40 years of their life surrounded by people who are more like them than their own mate. And see, that again is another complexity of our culture. And that's where a lot of emotional adultery can happen because, again, you know, you sit around and say, well, you know, I married my wife and all she does is talk about biology and medicine. I don't have a clue what she's talking about. I just sit there and listen and she tells me about her job and that's nice. But you know, the people I really get along with are all the women I work with, and we sit around and talk accounting, and our brains work the same. See, that's part of the, when you think about our culture, that's part of the issues that we face living in this culture. Again, and I think that Peterson's on to something. It's a profound thought. The level of temptation, because we work in the same space, is higher, but then the obstacles to creating closeness in a relationship, particularly if you marry when you're young, and then you go off and again work with people that are more like you, that are more wired like you than your mate. See, those are issues you have to watch in our culture. You have to be aware of those kinds of issues, and they can sneak up on you. That's, again, when we talk about the complexity of the American culture, these are factors in that. And again, I'll just hit that again. You can have a relationship that's, if both people aren't committed emotionally and physically to that relationship, you're building on hay, wood, and stubble. There has to be that commitment level to that. And again, I would simply say this. The sign that you're committed, the first sign is that you're willing to stand before a preacher and God in a room full of people and make that commitment. Make that commitment. Secondly, not only is a lack of commitment an obstacle to marriage, a good marriage, I mean, it's an obstacle to marriage, but also seeing each other as enemies instead of compliments is going to be a real problem in a marriage. You don't want to get into the battle of the sexes. You don't want to do that. And it makes for funny TV. And so many of the comedies on TV, the root of the comedy is the battle of the sexes. And particularly the old comedies of in the 50s and 60s, there was always the woman who's at home and the guy who's out working. And there's always an issue of, you know, either the husband was stupid, or you know, the man was, or the wife was ditzy, or you know, somehow men were smarter or women were smarter, and you would have those issues. You don't want to get into that. It can be funny on TV, but you really don't want a relationship where it's maleness versus femaleness. The truth of the matter is again, maleness complements femaleness and vice versa. We're each other's helpmates. And if you're a man, you're wise when you're able to say, my wife is better at doing a lot of different things than I am, and I ought to let her do it, and I'll follow her. And you're wise if you're a woman, if you say, my husband is better at a lot of other stuff, and where he's better, where his masculinity is an asset, I'm going to follow him. And instead, see each other on the same team, not have this endless struggle about, you know, think of it like this. Sometimes you have this in a relationship. Sometimes the husband is a lot harder on the kids. Sometimes the wife is a lot more graceful. Now, a lot of times it's flipped. Look at the other person and see that as an asset. You know? I think if the husband's a little harder, I think the wife needs to say, thank goodness John Wayne lives in this house. And thank goodness there's a sheriff in town. Because I wouldn't want to have to raise these kids without a sheriff. I'm glad somebody can sort of raise his voice and everybody chill out. That's a great asset to have. I'm not going to go around all the time telling him, now you got to be gentle with the kids. You got to be. No, he's not Mr. Rogers. Thank God he's not Mr. Rogers. Don't make him be Mr. Rogers. Let him be John Wayne. And on the other hand, let her be the sensitive touch. Thank the Lord, she's got a sensitive touch and she can sit there and listen and she can be the person who can dry the tears. Thank goodness. Thank goodness somebody is there that they want to jump in that lap and be mothered. Thank goodness for that. Don't be at war with each other. Say, thank the Lord for you. And she says, thank the Lord for you. We're actually much better together than we would be apart. So don't see each other as enemies. Be committed. And then third, don't be hard to live with. It's a big one. You know, I was looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 13, which is the ultimate passage about love, and you have 15 characteristics here about that define love. But the bottom line of all of these is be easy to live with. I mean, think about this. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy, does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked. Some translations say easily provoked. Thinks no evil. In other words, it's not suspicious. You can't go on together with suspicious minds, Elvis would say. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things, believe all things, hopes all things, endures all things. I mean, think about that. If the Spirit is creating that kind of person in us, it's making us easy to be around. We're long-suffering. We're not proud. We're not people who have the answers to everything. I mean, how hard is it to live with a person who's always right? And that's the point. It doesn't parade itself. It's not puffed up. It doesn't envy. It's not competitive with you. It's happy when you do good. It's not rude. Love isn't rude. It's not about it. Doesn't seek its own. It's not easily provoked. It's not edgy. Love isn't always saying, "Why'd you say that? What do you mean by that?" That's not love. It's not easily provoked. You got to go a long way. You got to poke it a lot with a stick to get the bear going. You know? It believes things. It's optimistic. I mean, this is a person who's easy to live with. And as husbands and wives, we have to be working to be as easy to live with as we can. And we have to admit that we're not always easy to live with. In our humanity, it's not always, you know, we start out porcupines, you know, we got to get the quills out. And when you love a person, when you really love a person, you want to be easy to live with. I mean, I've told people, and I've shared this before, and I tell numerous people this in the course of a year. I say, as a doctor assigned you medicine that you're not taking, for your moods. I worked in mental health a long time. I know the power of those medicines. And if they say no, he says I'm bipolar, but I don't believe him. Okay. All right. My advice to you is to pray the Lord heals you, but take your medicine until he does. It's an act of love. People have to live with you. Now, I had to eat those words because when I went through my trial 2019 and I was losing my stuff, you know, Dad had got his cancer diagnosis and something broke inside of me. I was laying in bed. I'd been in bed a couple days and really down. And it had been building up over several weeks. And I've been to the ER at least once because I, you know, discovered the joy of panic attacks and thought I was having a heart attack and all of that. And the doctor had told me, I need to give you a pill to level you out. No, I'm not going to take the, you know, as a pastor, you have all kinds of issues when they bring up the word Zoloft. It's like, oh, some ultimate weakness. But I'm laying there and Jenny kneels down and she looks at me. And I say, I don't know what I'm going to do. And she says, well, I'll tell you. I just want my husband back. And I had told people for years, and I still tell them, you need to be easy to live with. It's an act of love to be easy to live with. And I thought, you know what? It's not fun living with me right now. If a pill will make me easier to live with, I'm going to go get the pill. And I did in that season of my life. It's an act of love to be easy to live with. That's what 1 Corinthians is about. Be easy to live with. I mean, that's why, you know, that's another reason why I don't think you should consume alcohol. Nobody gets easier to live with when you start drinking. Nobody gets more holy, and nobody gets easier to live with. Nobody after three beers says, you know what, I think I'm going to just go pray and read my Bible. No, you don't. After three beers, you're looking to get into trouble. Nobody gets holier when they drink. And nobody gets easier to live with when they drink. You start saying stupid things. You start doing stupid stuff. You start getting messier. You're not taking care of yourself. You become harder to live with the more you drink. And it's an act of love to be as easy to live with as you can. I preached this a couple of years ago, and not everybody appreciated what I had to say. But I'll say it again. I think there are two things that create, you know, barring just insane behavior, barring just having to live with an Amber Heard or Johnny Depp situation, barring that, I think that there are two things that probably undermine the happiness and well-being of a house more than any other. I think on the male side, it's anger. I think a lot of men struggle with their anger, and the problem with male anger is that it's physically threatening. Female anger isn't generally physically threatening unless she's got a pan. Male anger can be physically threatening, and particularly when kids are in the house, it makes things feel unsafe when the man doesn't seem to have control of his anger. And that can really mess up the dynamics of a house when it now isn't feeling physically safe for people. And I think a man's anger can really, really blow things. I mean, you want to mess up, and I've been here and I've been guilty of this, you want to mess up a road trip? Have a man driving with road rage, messes up the whole bloody trip. I was talking in a class once in North Carolina, and I think I've shared this with you before. Gary Smalley did these videos, and he did like 12 videos on how to have a great family. And he keeps previewing this, and he's saying, now later on in this series, I'm going to tell you the perfect thing to do if your family's not getting along. There's one thing you can do to bring everything together. So he's saying this, you know, and if you're watching it each week, now you're out 5 weeks, and it's like, what's the one thing? And he gets there, it's like, I don't know, episode 8 or 9, and his answer is, take a camping trip. You're there, there's teamwork, you're working, you put the tent up, everything's great, and so it's like, oh, there it is. And after the video was off, one of the girls said, I don't think she used the word stupid, but she said, basically she said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. We never took a camping trip that Dad didn't get mad and we all drove home in silence. Check out. Yeah, camping trips will bring it together unless Dad gets mad. Anger, yeah. And so again, it's the things you just have to control. I think the kickback is that it's the male anger that's a problem. And this is what people didn't appreciate me saying. The kickback is it's also female depression. There's nothing that messes up the flow and happiness of just having the home than a person who is in a dark place that's unhappy. And when she sits down in the living room, everybody else has to sort of, you know, be nice to mom. Don't, you know, mom's on the edge. Mom's always on the edge. Don't offend mom. Don't do that. Don't. Those are things that, again, I'm talking about what it means to love. These things make us hard to live with, and a loving person wants to be easy to live with. That's the great act of love. I mean, that's why, you know, you go back to Mel Inger, where it says, don't provoke your children to wrath. Don't do that. Don't get up in their face. Don't allow, if you're a male, the anger to destroy your house. Argumentativeness. Y'all remember the old Bob Newhart skit? It's like one of the classic skits where he's the psychiatrist and the woman comes in, and I don't know, she's seen three or four psychiatrists, and there she is. He's been recommended, and she takes out her pad, and I think he just says, no, you won't need the pad. It never takes longer than 5 minutes with me. And she said, you know, it's amazing. He says it's like $5 for the first 5 minutes, and it seldom takes me more than 5 minutes to fix anybody. And so she starts telling all the things going on, and he says, all right, well, I have a word for you. Stop it. Stop it. And then she says something like, yeah, but my mother. He said, no, we don't go there. Just stop it. Just stop it. And, you know, there are a lot of things, and I don't know how you're going to do it. You're going to have to have God's help. But just stop it. Just stop it. I know a couple, they don't attend church here, but when they get in an argument, it's 2 or 3 o'clock in the night. Nobody will just stop it. Just stop it. Be done. I mean, why do you have to have the last word? Just stop it. I mean, are you going to live this way for the next 50 years? Just stop. And at some point, it's a lack of love. It's a lack of love. If you know it irritates them that much, just stop it. It's not a problem. Take your shoes off. Put the clothes in the hamper. Put the towels where she tells you to put the towels. Mow the grass when she asks you to mow the... It's not that complicated. Generally speaking. Generally speaking. If she's not crazy, it's not that complicated. So, again, one problem is we're not committed. Another problem is that somehow we're engaged in this battle of John Wayne versus Leave It to Beaver's mama, you know. And we're in this trying to figure out who's the greater sex, you know. Another issue is that we're not practicing love. We're not. We say it, we talk about it, but we're not working to be easy to be around. We're not working. Something else, and this is fourth, we're not tender towards each other. And I think this flows into this. We're not tender towards each other. Again, you know, we say this a lot, but Matthew chapter 19, when Jesus is asked why Moses allowed divorce, he said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it wasn't so. What Jesus is saying there is that the reason divorce was permitted in the Old Testament in a greater way than the New is because God recognized people's hearts got hard, and apparently he let them out, or he gave them a way out. The only real reason, again, people do get divorced is because of the hardness of heart. You have to stay tender towards each other. You do. There has to be a tenderness towards each other. There has to be an empathy towards each other. And I say that like it's easy. It's not, because life hardens us. You know, you're dating her. First time she cries, you've been dating a month, and her cat dies. The first time she cries, man, you're there. Oh, you're on the spot. You're there with chocolates. You know, you've been married 20 years. Your cat dies. It's like, what's for dinner? You know? Praise the Lord. We're going to save some money on food. I mean, you just thought, there's a lack of tenderness there, and you have to work on that. You know, my kid. I remember when Ava was young, and man, she was our firstborn. So you know, by the time you get into the third or fourth, you know, you're already a little hard there. But that man, that firstborn is like, man, you're soft. And I can remember looking at her and watching her lay there, and I would say, I never want her to feel rejected. I would say that to myself. I never want her to ever feel rejected by me. Man, now she's 13, and if the event lasted an hour, it takes her 3 hours to tell about the event. There are no summations with her. And man, it's like, it's not what it used to be. I keep telling myself, it's like, I don't want her to feel rejected, but she's got to be easier to live with. Come on, man. There's, again, you have to work on being tender towards each other. It has to be the softness, you know. And again, the longer you're married, the easier it is to just write off people's feelings and, you know, you just not touch. It's hard to be sympathetic. We've had this discussion before, but if you let your heart get hard towards each other and you don't fix it, you're going to lose half your stuff. You got to keep your heart soft towards each other and tender. Another thing, let me see. I'm sorry, I've got stuff all over the place. First, I'm doing this for me, not for you. You're not committed. Second of all, you don't see each other as allies. You see each other as enemies. Third, you're not easy to live with. Fourth, you're not being tender towards each other. Fifth, you've got unreasonable expectations. Now, I wouldn't have low expectations in regards to moral behavior. And I don't know that I would be all that tolerant about rudeness. I wouldn't be tolerant about pornography or swearing or adultery. Those are things I wouldn't be tolerant of. But in spite of the fact that we're working to love each other and be easy to live with, we're still going to be human. So you've got to be loving me, I've got to be loving you, but in response, there also has to be a lot of grace going back and forth. Because even at my best, I'm still very human. Still very human. I still do a lot of dumb stuff. At my best, there are decisions that you make that it's just not a good decision. People change. We have weaknesses. And James Dobson wrote this. Dobson was a great marriage counselor. And he's asked this question about a wife who's talking about her husband who is emotionally disconnected. He's not good at sharing his feelings. He's not good at communication. And he says to her, "My advice is that you change what can be altered, explain that which can be understood, teach that which can be learned, revise that which can be improved, resolve that which can be settled, and negotiate that which is open to compromise. Create the best marriage possible from the raw materials brought by two imperfect people with two distinct personalities. But for all the rough edges that can never be smoothed and the faults that can never be eradicated, try to develop the best possible perspective and determine in your mind to accept reality exactly as it is. The first principle of mental health is to accept that which cannot be changed. You could easily go to pieces over adverse circumstances that are beyond your control. You can determine to hang tough or you can yield to cowardice. Depression is often evidence of emotional surrender. Can you accept the fact that your husband will never be able to meet all of your needs and aspirations? Seldom does one human being satisfy every longing and hope in another. Obviously, this coin has two sides. You can't be his perfect woman either. He is no more equipped to resolve your entire package of emotional needs than you are to become his sexual dream machine for every 24 hours. Both partners have to settle for human foibles and faults and irritability and fatigue and occasional nighttime headaches. A good marriage is not one in which perfection reigns. It is a relationship in which a healthy perspective overlooks a multitude of unresolvables. Thank goodness my wife Shirley has adopted this attitude towards me. Again, you're not married to perfection. I'm not married to perfection. It will never be perfection. We can work to love each other. We can work to make ourselves easier to live with. But in the end, there's got to be a lot of grace. And then six, a lot of times I think marriages struggle because they don't have a common encompassing goal or purpose. I think if you're going to have a really good marriage, the marriage has to mean something. There has to be a purpose to us being together. Other than that, we don't want to be alone. There's got to be why are we together? What's the God-given purpose for us being together? What is it that we're going to accomplish in the world for the kingdom of God together? I mean, that's a big deal. And when you start thinking in those terms of, hey, God brought us together for His glory and for a kingdom purpose, what are we going to do together that we could not have done alone that's going to have eternal implications? Boy, now you're talking about a marriage that can really, really be something to behold. I think you struggle if the marriage is just, you know, we stay together because we can't afford to be apart, and we'd be lonely if we weren't together, and no good reason to get a divorce. I mean, at some point you wonder if that's going to be a good situation. But when you say, listen, it's vital to the kingdom of God that we stay together. This has eternal implications for us. Boy, now you're starting to take it to a higher level. And then seven, sometimes marriages struggle, and I think this has been said here, so I'll just hit it briefly. When we're not thankful for each other. We're not thankful for each other. Proverbs 18:22 says, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing." 1 Corinthians 7:7 says, "For I wish that all men were even as myself, but each one has his gift from God, one in this manner and another after that." Marriage is a gift. Your mate is a gift. And you ought to think of her as a gift. You ought to think of him as a gift. Particularly if you believe God brought you together. If you believe that God brought this union together, you ought to give thanks for that gift that God has given. There ought to be gratitude towards God for her. Everything that we've said tonight comes to the single conclusion that we need God. That we need God. That we need God. But think about it in reverse, and I'm finished here. Think about what your marriage would look like if you were completely committed to each other till death do us part. Think about what it would be if we saw each other as allies and not enemies. Think about what it would be if both of us took the attitude that, listen, love means being easy to live with, and I want God to continue to work in my life, and you pray the same thing, so that the rough edges can start to come off of us. And we can be sensitive to each other. What would a marriage look like if we were intentional about remaining tender-hearted towards each other and kind? We're tender. We were still in touch, and that was important to us. What would the relation look like, again, if we could figure out what God wanted to accomplish in our union for the sake of His kingdom, and if we lived with daily gratitude that God brought us together and brought this union together. I think that those are the building pieces of a quality, godly marriage. And again, as you think about that, we need God to bring that about. That's not easy to do. But if somehow we can get close to that, we can work towards it, the marriage can be what God designed it to be, a blessing and a gift to us. Amen.